Commentary is for general information purposes only. Clients should seek professional advice for their particular situation.
These markets are giving me a headache, I think.
I was recently watching The Secret of Whales on Netflix with my two daughters, and I was blown away by the differences between the species of whales. Some whales are big, others small. Some are vicious, others are not. The dwarf sperm whale is the smallest whale in the world, and it is smaller than most dolphins. On the other end of the spectrum, the blue whale is the largest, and one of the largest animals to have ever lived on planet Earth. The average length of a blue whale is between 70 and 90 feet, which is the equivalent to the length of two school buses. Another example, killer whales have teeth, which helps them eat fish, seals, and other marine animals, whereas blue whales lack teeth but have large sheets of baleen in their mouths, which act as a strainer to consume small, shrimp-like crustaceans. As of time of recording, we are in a bear market. A bear market is defined as a decline of 20% or more from the peak. There have been 15 bear markets since the 1950s. However, similar to whales, not all bear markets are the same. In general, we can classify them into two buckets: baby bears and big bears, with the baby bears meaning a bear market outside of a recession, while a big bear is a bear market that occurs in a recessionary environment. Is there a lot to learn from their differences? Can previous bear markets provide clues on the future? We attempt to address these questions and many more. Listen on. This is Investments Unplugged. Welcome back to Investments Unplugged. I am your co-host, Mark Ania, co-chief investment strategist, joined here as always with my partner in crime, Kevin Headland. Welcome, Kev.
Hey, Mark, how's it going?
Well, not bad. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. These markets are giving me a headache, I think.
Yeah, you don't say that with too much conviction. You sound exhausted like the rest of us. This is the most exhausting start to the year that we can remember. And now it's transitioned to one of the most exhausting first halves to the years because there's been nowhere to hide. Typically, when we've got these bear markets, as we are in one right now, you've had fixed income to really support a typical balanced asset allocation. And bonds have sold off as well. So I think that's adding to the exhaustion levels. But as we've outlined in our notes, various podcasts, we think that dynamic will change at some point in the second half of this year. But the point of this podcast is a little bit more of a history lesson, shall we say. What I mean by that is looking at previous bear markets and seeing if we can really look into them in terms of trying to get some information out of history to help us with our investment decisions or our conversations with our clients.
You know, everyone's trying to call the bottom of the market right now. And you know, I think this is where we're trying to look at past bear markets, past sell-offs to determine if there are similarities that we could give us some kind of indication of where we are in the sell-off. Are we close to the bottom? Are we farther away from the bottom? But I think that's where history helps give us a bit of a guide. Obviously, nothing is perfect, but at least we can see if there's some similarities in terms of how far other bear markets have fallen.
Kev, if you remember, I was going through these and we looked at previous bear markets to draw comparisons. And what I thought was interesting was I hadn't updated the COVID data and the bottom hadn't hit yet in March when we were talking about this in 2020. So the trough in 2020 was March 23rd, and I had last updated this March 17th. So it made me think like we were literally a week away from hitting the bottom. I don't think that's the case this time, but we do believe we are closer today to that bottom than what we were a couple of weeks ago. Now, bear markets by definition is a sell-off of greater than 20% from the peak. And when we look at the data going back to 1950, there's been, you know, Kev, actually, I'm going to quiz you. Do you know how many bear markets there's been since 1950?
I actually have the data in front of me, so that's not a fair question.
So not a fair question. There's literally been 15 bear markets since 1950. Do we include some of those that weren't real bear markets? For example, the European debt crisis. Its market sold off peak to trough 19.4%. We included that as a bear market. The Asian currency crisis back in 97, 98 was very similar to 19.3. So for this context of this discussion, we included those ones that were within basically a half 0.5 to 0.6% of reaching that bear market. So there's been 15 of them. It's interesting, you can put them into two separate buckets. And what we call them is we call them the baby bears versus the big bears. The baby bears are those bear markets that have happened outside of recessions. Of the 15, seven of them are these baby bears. I'm just going to quickly go through them. European debt crisis, the Asian currency crisis, the 76 bear market, Q4 18 bear market, 61 bear market, and of course the 87 crash. And when you look at the distribution of those sell-offs, they range from 19.4% to the big one being the 87 crash at 33%. When you take the average sell-off during these baby bears since 1950 has been 23%. If you have a view that we are not going to hit a recession over the next year, one could argue we've already priced in a lot of the negativity based on historical numbers.
23.5% happens to be the biggest peak to drawdown we've experienced this time around. And that occurred as of June 16th. That was the recent bottom, shall we say. So interesting, 23% average, and that's what we hit since we bottomed out, and we rallied since then.
Yeah, so we're back out of that bear market now. I think last time I checked on the Bloomberg, we're down 18% in the US.
Yeah, 18 and a half, yeah.
We've talked about this dynamic many times in terms of it's still our view that the Fed is going to be less hawkish than current market expectations. And the very same headwind that we've experienced for bond and equities for the first 6 months of the year will turn into a tailwind. And as you said, we've rallied 5% since middle of last week. We continue to find it difficult to see a Fed go at the pace that the markets are expecting in an economy that is weakening. We're slowly getting to that environment, Kev, where bad news becomes good news. Because the bad news from an economic perspective, although it's not recessionary, may provide the Fed more flexibility not to raise rates at the path that the markets are expecting. The market's expecting that we're going to get a neutral rate of 3.25 to 3.5 by Jan of next year. And we just don't see that in the cards with inflation coming off, trending towards 4%, and in a weakening global economy, we just can't see the Fed raising at that rates.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the market expecting the Fed essentially to go at all costs, all speeds, full steam ahead to help reduce inflation at the cost of a recession. And I think now, as we're seeing some of that economic data start to soften, I would say, there's expectation now that the economy will reduce inflation a bit on its own and therefore help the Federal Reserve a bit. So I think that's why it's slowly starting to expect that peak rates are near that 3.5 and perhaps are going to slow down the back of half of next year. But I think that's the idea, is it's not just the Fed that's going to be slowing inflation, but the economy as well. And time will tell where we get inflation by end of this year. But we do believe, just like we're getting closer to the bottom of the equity market, we're also likely getting to the peak of the yield and fixed income, as well as peak inflation.
And let's not lose sight of how quickly the narrative can change. I think we're hearing these recession narrative today, and we're setting that in stone. I look no further than the Fed path in terms of what markets have expected. Remember early January, which seems like ages ago now, but markets were expecting three rate hikes in very short order that went up to eight, nine. And even a couple of weeks ago, now everyone and their family members have said, oh, I've been calling a 75 basis point rate hike for June and July. No, you didn't. No one was calling this a month ago. And then the Fed changes tune a bit, and then that was priced into June. We saw that. That was priced in for the next one in July. We saw the expectations increase. Things can change very quickly. The narrative can change. Look at the narrative of even inflation. A year and a half ago, we were discussing whether it was inflation was transitory and enduring. And most people back then thought that it was going to be transitory. Fast forward, and you see it's here, but doesn't mean that inflation is going to be sticky today or enduring going moving forward. We got to look forward. Hopefully we do get a baby bear. We may get a big bear. We may not. But let's look at historically the performance of markets during these big bears. And as I mentioned before, these big bears happened around recessions. So if we go back to the previous ones, as I said, of the 15 bear markets, 8 of them are these big bears. And the last time we got one, obviously, was COVID, then great financial crisis, go through them, .com, 1990, the 70 recession, 73, 74, 80, and 56. The average sell-off in these periods is 37%. So if you are of the view that we will get a hard landing, and what the markets mean by that is a recession, there could be more downside based on history. But what I point out with this is, yeah, 37%, but that 37% is really impacted by three really big sell-offs. Number one, great financial crisis. We saw a 57% decrease. Dot-com was roughly 50, and the 73-74 recession was 50%. Could we get a recession? Perhaps. I think, Kev, when we look at it, and we're in the process of updating our chart book, the signs are, as of today, with the Fed raising rates at this aggressive stance, energy prices at these levels, and so on, we might get a recession at some point in the first half of next year. That's in the cards. But that's assuming there's no change in that. I think to get to that 50% from these levels is we need a shock to the system. Dot-com, there was a shock. The great financial crisis, there was a shock. In the 73-74, there was a massive recession. And when we look at everything, and yes, things are slowing, but you know what continues to remain resilient, Kev? The U.S. consumer, or consumers in general. And as long as they remain in a resilient position, it's hard for me to envision a severe recession to get us another 20% down from here.
Yeah, I think when you look at the consumer, you look at the employment environment in the U.S., and it's extremely strong. You know, we're at 3.6% unemployment. Obviously, participation rate is low, but it has been starting to pick up. But there's a solid environment, I would say, around the employment picture. And Governor Powell was even talking about, okay, even if maybe the unemployment rate moves higher to 4.1%, and people were almost shocked at that. And it's like, that is still very attractive unemployment numbers. And I think that's important to understand that, as you said, those material deep recessions coupled with these big bears tend to be very negative for the employment market. You know, it's a consumption-driven recession. And I don't think it's something we see right now. As you said, it would be very difficult to see that shock that would happen where you would see other economic data continue to weaken and a very large change in the employment market.
Listen, at the end of the day, these systematic shocks, no one ever sees them, right? Like, look at Greece with the European. I remember, even let's go back further, the great financial crisis. I remember being in meetings where analysts were saying, why do we care about the U.S. subprime market? It's only 2% of the overall bond market in the U.S. And we saw what happened, because we didn't see the interconnectedness below the hood. Look at Greece. Oh, it's only 2% of the European GDP. We know what happened. So usually these issues are on the back page and we never see them coming, but let's try to pretend that we can see them coming. And I look at what happened. So we are recording this on June 27th, 2022. And overnight we got preliminary, basically headlines of Russia defaulting on a payment. Markets didn't react at all to that. And I thought another interesting thing was from the Fed stress tests last week. So the Fed came out with their stress test results. They put the banks through various scenario analysis. And under the scenario where unemployment would skyrocket to 10% and the markets would sell off 50% from their peak to trough, so double of what they have so far, the banks would still pass their stress test. So that gives me utmost confidence that the likelihood of a systematic shock to the system is minimal. I know, Kev, we were talking with Dan Janis and his team this morning, and they were talking about the health of U.S. credit corporations. They were also, I know we've talked to people from our private equity side. So on the private side, despite, yes, challenges to margins, no doubt with wages and inflation, they remain resilient. This is the way we've been thinking about it. We're not going to sit here and say that there's not more downside from these levels. But the question is okay, where's the opportunity cost? Do we think that we get our down 50% at these levels, Kev? I think we would both say no. I think the odds of that happening are very low. Could we be down 10%? Yeah, based on averages, we could be. But where's the opportunity cost for an investor? Is the opportunity cost for an investor who has a medium to long-term time horizon, is it the next 10% down? Or is it the potential next leg of the bull market, which will be at some point over the next year where you get those outsized returns? I think we can't be too cute to save 10% from here, because what we'll end up doing is costing us that bull market returns moving forward.
Well, I think I remember back in March 2020, and we're down 35% on March 23rd, and we were all discussing about, you know, how much more can it go? No one was talking about a bottom, really, or was saying, oh, this is, you know, the depths of a crisis, a pandemic, you know, a lot of unknowns. And people were saying, okay, is it, you know, 1920s type a sell-off? Is it, you know, a Great Depression? How far do the markets fall as it goes on 50%? And that was the bottom, 35%. And if you were trying to sell out to protect, again, that incremental move lower, you missed out on a very nice, strong rally. And we all know that the sell is the easy decision. But if you do sell, you have to get back in. And deciding when to get back in is the difficult point, because if the markets start to rally, you hold off, you wait, you're expecting a double dip, another better opportunity to get back in. And sometimes that doesn't happen. Again, I'm not saying, you know, we're not saying this is the similar environment, but trying to either time a bottom to get in or try and predict how much more there is left to go in order to save that incremental dollar, as you said, puts a lot of risk on the table. You know, I look at this environment, you go back to baby bears, big bears, this screams Q4 2018 to me. You know, slower economic data, not recessionary just yet, Fed raising rates, yield spiking, and you get a market sell-off, a repricing of assets, shall we say. And then 2019 was still strong. Eventually, you get a recession in 2020, but that was also not consumption-led. But we are seeing weaker fundamental data, similar to what we're seeing today, and then we get the market sell-off.
Yeah, that's a great point. And we ask ourselves this, is do you have a plan in place for the downside? And what I mean by that is, a couple of weeks ago, we entered bear market territory. Seemed like a change in narrative from the Fed, and markets rallied, I think it was 9% over a 6-day period. And when we were having discussions with clients, they were saying, we think that we're going to retest the bear market. And we have. And when we have discussions with those very same investors, they're paralyzed. They don't know what to do. What I ask is, okay, now we've got another, again, we've recovered. I think we're down 18%. We've gained 5%. And we're getting the same thing from advisors is, oh, there could be another sell-off. Okay. But when that happens, is do you have the same plans that you have set into place for your clients? Do you have one yourself to allocate your clients' money at these levels? Because the last thing we all want to do, and Kev, how many times do we hear this? We hear investors say, oh, I wish I took advantage of March 2020. That was a great opportunity. I didn't. Or even when it was going back even further, the great financial crisis, when it was March of 2009. I wish I took advantage. Or any weakness is what we often do, is when the opportunity presents itself, we get in our own ways mentally. We don't actually do what we know we need to do, right? So put a plan in place in terms of how you're going to allocate capital in periods like this. Kev, we always say a very easy way to remove the emotion out of it is dollar cost average. It's an easy way to get money into the market. So in the event that, let's say you're wrong and markets rally and this was the bottom, that you're actually putting in money through the upside. In the event that, let's say you are right and we do get another 5 to 10% sell off, then you increase that monthly payment. But the key to today is, and I think we look back in 3 to 5 years, is did you take advantage of this weakness? And that's one thing I look at. I mean, we went through this, Kev, right? Many times, the baby bear, big bear, and actually gave me a lot of confidence after doing the analysis. And you know what's a consistent theme in each one of these? We get through these periods And when you typically invest when markets are down this minus 20 or minus 30, we have the tables. We will be sharing with them with our sales team and in our investment notes and the podcast, LinkedIn. But the odds, listen, we don't have a crystal ball. But when you look at the previous big recession, so COVID, Great Financial Crisis, dot-com, 1990, 1980, 73, 74, 70, and 56. When you're at these bear market sell-offs, the odds are overwhelmingly in your favor to be up in 1 year time or 2 years, but even more so from a 3 year perspective.
These sell-offs and the idea of like, oh, I'm going to take advantage of these sell-offs, it's not necessarily that markets turn on a dime and you know, 1 month, 2 months later, you're up huge and you made a lot of money. This is the time that patient investors are rewarded. It's very difficult to put money to work often, but putting the money to work and understanding your time horizon and timeline, that patient investor is going to be rewarded. And whether it's 2 years or 3 years, looking back, as I said, over the period when you go back every time there's a big sell-off, you, as you said, you might have regretted missing out on it. But if you do put money to work, you tend to be very, very happy down the road because you put that money to work. And sometimes, as you said, it's hard. I think you've said it, you know, when it makes you sick to your stomach, that's usually a good time to buy. And we have the data showing, you know, when the VIX over 30 and baby bears and big bears, when markets sell off, it's a good idea to put some money to work. You know, the first key is do not sell. But the second key, I think, is putting that money to work and taking advantage of these sell-offs because we don't get them very often. You said 15, going back to the 50s. That's it. That is not a lot of bear markets. We don't get them often. When we do, we should take advantage of them because over long term, it makes sense and investors do well.
Yeah, we're seeing some of that dynamic that clients want to put money to work, but they don't feel comfortable in either the equity markets or the bond markets. So what we are seeing is advisors, with rates being higher, locking in, let's say, some cash in GIC rates, which relative to their historical, what you would get from them are attractive, depending on which bank and so on. They can yield any and duration anywhere between 3% and 4%. We have many slides that show this, but also within that space, I think when that type of investing, you're looking in the rear view mirror. You're looking at what bonds have given you over the past, let's say, 2 years, and you're looking at what you could lock in GIC rates. Our work suggests it's during these periods, GICs outperform bond indices, and we're going to look at it from the DEX universe, the Canadian Universal Bond Index. The history goes back to early 2000s. It's rare for GICs to outperform bonds. And when you look back at the data, it's roughly only 20% of the time. Or said differently, bonds outperform 1 year GIC rates 80% of the time. Yes, it's been tough slog, obviously, this year and last year. But because of that tough slog, the opportunity it has been one that we haven't seen in years. Kev, when was the last time that we saw Roshan, who is our lead Canadian fixed income manager, or even Dan today, Dan and Tommy in the US? And obviously, they're optimistic because they're bond managers, but there is some genuine enthusiasm with the opportunities that they're seeing today.
Well, I think you haven't seen yields at these levels in quite some time. You know, last time we saw 10-year yields anywhere near that was, oh, surprise, surprise, fourth quarter of 2018, right? And yields fell materially after that, right? And we have to understand, I think, as those that are investing in bonds, the nuances of the fact that, yes, yields were not as attractive and past performance is now negative year to date for many and almost all fixed income asset classes. But as you said, it's the go forward, right? Over the next year, what's going to happen? And already we're starting at points where the yields are much higher across many fixed income asset classes. So that's already attractive. But the key is when yields start to fall, especially as we start to embrace longer duration fixed income, given the weakness in the economic data, those yields eventually start to fall as data continues to get weaker. And we're getting longer and later in the economic cycle and leading into recession. When yields fall, prices go up, and you actually generate a total return that is much greater than the initial yield of those bonds. And I think investors don't understand perhaps the nuances, or it's very difficult to understand the complete nuances of the fixing a marketplace. And as you said, it's about the go forward, right? So I can own something that pays me a certain amount, and maybe starting off, the yields are similar. However, when you look back a year later, often because the increase in prices of your fixed income instrument, you end up having a much better total return. It's very difficult for them to see that because it's in the future and we don't know what the future holds. But as you said, time and time again, the data has proven that fixed income ends up winning out in the end.
So let's transition to that and the model portfolio and end off the conversation there. So for those that are new, the model portfolio is a paper portfolio that the team has been running for over 10 years now. The view of it is for a typical balanced investor, 60-40. If we make changes to it, the changes have to be quarter end. We try to take the view of the advisor. We appreciate and recognize that advisors aren't changing their asset allocation daily, weekly, monthly, probably not even quarterly. But at minimum, that's what we believe we should do. It's rebalanced every quarter. And right now we are 70% equities, 30% fixed income. Our equities are 30% United States, 15 Canada, 15 international, 10 EM, and our bonds are in higher quality credit.
And global in nature and fixed income, so go anywhere.
Yes. So we have a decision to make, Kev, and what do we do? What are we discussing? We haven't come to an agreement yet, but let's talk about some of the options on the table.
The main option is reduce equities either 5 or 10% and add a fixed income, as again, we're seeing the data indicate that we're at the latter stages of the economic cycle and it makes sense to embrace fixed income. Ideally, we would want a nice equity rally so you sell into rallies, but that is not always the perfect scenario. But that's one of the areas we're looking at. Of course, if we're looking at adding to fixed income, we have to determine where to reduce our equity exposure.
The way we're looking at it is many of you are familiar with our table of recession indicators, and we're probably going to add another one to a caution, which is U.S. housing starts that have been declining. Now, again, we still think the odds of a recession in 2022 are low, but they are increasing at the current rate going into 2023. Now, let's say the Fed pivots, energy prices come off. It's a different narrative, but as of right now, that's what we have to work with. We don't make big steps. We ease into our positions. So that's why we're thinking about reducing our equities by 5 and then adding it to fixed income. Where we're thinking about reducing it, and this is a different dynamic as well, Kev. Let's look at the world and region. Canada, another one is US, international being Europe primarily, and another one being emerging markets, i.e. Asia. And I think we are thinking most likely that we will be reducing, if we do this, taking 5% maybe out of our international weight and adding it to bonds. When we look at the regions in terms of growth profile, earnings expectations, and valuations, we're still very comfortable with the U.S., a bit Canada, obviously, and emerging markets. The one part with international, specifically Europe, is the war in Ukraine. I think it has surprised all of us in terms of the length that it keeps going to. And it doesn't seem like there's any end in sight. So that's still going to be a near-term, hopefully it's a near-term headwind. Hopefully they resolve it. But it could be a near to medium-term headwind for European energy prices. Could be an impact on inflation. Could be an impact on margins, on the job market, on disposable income. So that's why when we're looking at the international weight, we still think a dollar invested in international today will be positive in a year time. I think that's very important to highlight. But we think the upside is higher in the rest of the world. And when we look at international equities versus bonds, and Kevin, you really laid out a nice environment for bonds in terms of, let's say your yield is 4. Let's say you get some spread compression. You're looking at maybe 6-7% today on a one-year forward basis versus international equities that might get you 10 to 12. From a risk-adjusted perspective, starting to become very attractive. And I think that, listen, we can't get rid of fixed income, and nor should we. But imagine I was telling you today that we could be putting fixed income into our portfolio at yields of north of 4%, with total return upside that you eloquently laid out, it becomes a lot more attractive.
From the international developed market world, as you said, Europe predominantly, I keep using a word of visibility. and my visibility is not as clear in that area of the world when I'm trying to compare the asset classes of the different regions. I think that's key. And we're, you know, obviously companies are well positioned there, and there's a lot of good opportunities and great opportunities long term. But in the near term, there's a lot of clouds and that visibility is not there. And I think that's why if we're looking at the relative opportunity set, as you said, that may be one area where it's not as clear as the others.
Visibility is a great word, Kevin. We're optimistic. Clearly, we've outlined that over the past couple of podcasts in our notes. So why increase fixed income? What if we're wrong? What if we are wrong and the Fed does go this aggressive? Like, let's look at this environment. We are talking about in the US 8.6% inflation. 2 years ago, if we were on this podcast talking about, you know, we have our fearless forecast where we come out with these crazy forecasts of what may happen. Even 8.6% inflation would have never hit a fearless forecast because it was that crazy. Why? Because we had unprecedented amounts of stimulus pumped into a system, and now we're taking all of that out. So we still have to be very mindful and honest with ourselves that, you know, we need to build some defensive mechanisms in the portfolio in the event that we're wrong. And in the event that we do get a recession in the near term, I think adding to fixed income at these levels with the yields that we're getting from an asset allocation perspective and a risk-adjusted perspective for our clients, it makes sense.
Even if the Fed goes as aggressive as the market expects, without even going faster, the data suggests a higher risk of recession in the first half of 2023. You know, there's even pricing right now on Federal Reserve rate levels to see some cuts start to happen in the back half of next year. So we're already looking at that aspect. And I think when you see these expectations for that start to turn, that's when it pays to add duration in different areas of the world, but adding duration where you're getting a good yield from. When you start getting that increased risk of recession, you start to see the bond markets that are priced it in, yields fall. And once again, the prices go higher as yields fall. And it makes a smart, prudent approach to start embracing duration as we're toward the latter stage of the economic cycle.
I think that's a very good natural endpoint to stop the discussion. Is there anything, Kev, that you want to add?
No, I just hope we get a nice rally in the next couple of days and makes our decision a little bit easier in terms of the asset allocation.
Yeah, and I think the message that we've been communicating is that of optimism. It's very hard to be optimistic at this point. Both equities and bonds have been hit, but I think revisiting this Excel spreadsheet and updating our points, it actually has given me even more confidence that we know we're going to get through this, but there have been worse periods and we made it through that. Worse recessions, we've been through that. Worse systematic shocks to the system, we've made it through that. We're dealing today with not that high inflation is not something to be concerned with, but we need to be looking forward and not looking in the rearview mirror, as you say, Kev, because we can't assume what's happened in the past is going to continue going. And you know what? Going through this exercise, the case is it never happens. The past rarely repeats itself. It rhymes, but it rarely repeats itself moving forward. So continue to be optimistic. Take advantage of the weakness, because I think we will look back at this point in many years down the road and think again to ourselves that this was a good investment opportunity for those clients who have a medium to long-term perspective. So with that, thank you again to all our listeners. We are always shocked when we go out on the road and advisors and people come up to us saying, oh, we love the podcast. We always tape these and they go into a black hole, we feel, but it's really nice to get the positive feedback. I know our marketing team and our producer Peter was telling us, I think last year there was 50,000 downloads. Just boggles my mind. And that would not happen without every single one of you listening in. Hopefully it's on a per podcast basis, but just listening in period. So thank you so much. We really appreciate it. And with that, I'm going to sign off. My name is Makan Nia.
And Kevin Hedlund.
And thank you for listening to Investments Unplugged.
Copyright Manulife. Commentary is for general information purposes only and shouldn't be relied on for specific financial, legal, or other advice and does not constitute an offer or an invitation by or on behalf of Manulife Investment Management to any person to buy or sell any security. Opinions expressed are those of Manulife and or the sub-advisor of Manulife Investment Management and are subject to change based on market and other conditions. Manulife isn't responsible for any losses arising from any use of this information. Manulife funds are managed by Manulife Investment Management Limited, formerly named Manulife Asset Management Limited. Manulife Investment Management is a trade name of Manulife Investment Management Limited. Commissions, trailing commissions, management fees, and expenses all may be associated with mutual fund investments. Please read the fund facts and prospectus before investing. Mutual funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. This information does not replace or supersede KYC, Know Your Client, suitability, needs analysis, or any other regulatory requirements.